contribution is simply to hope to be able to tell you a little bit about the story of where we're coming from today. John Bennett Laws was born in Rothamsted Manor in 1814. At the age of 28, he took out a patent for the manufacture of superphosphate and started the first world's manufacture of an industrial phosphate fertilizer, which has led, of course, to the huge fertilizer industry that we have today. But in 1843, he appointed Joseph Henry Gilbert to help set up and supervise the experiments on crop nutrition that he was keen to start on Rothamsted Farm. And so the first experiments were laid down in the autumn of 1843. But to give you a little bit of a clue as to why he chose the treatments in those experiments, it's probably necessary to know a little bit about the changing agriculture in England. By the early 18th century, the arable land in each village was divided between a few fields and managed on an open field principle. So that initially the cropping was simply fallow cereal, and then the following later was fallow legume cereal. And to allow for lack of uniformity of the soil and fertility in each field, it was divided into many strips, and each villager was allotted so many strips in each field. This is a map of Crawley Mill Farm at Woburn, on the Woburn Duke of Bedford estates at Woburn. We have an interest there because at the moment we have an outstation at Woburn. And here you can see all the fields divided up into strips. Each one is numbered, each one has a name on it. The interesting feature too is, of course, that because at that time only cereals were being grown, wheat essentially, the centre of the village was the mill that was going to mill the corn to produce the flour. And here it was a mill driven by water power, so there was the stream that was backing it up. But by the 1700s, the population of England was about 6 million, and about 30% of the land was in this open field system. It was socially advantageous. People had to learn to live and work together. Socially very, very advantageous. But to be self-sufficient, that was necessary, but production was clearly limited. And so we go from the 1750s to the 1830s. There were what were in Britain called the Enclosure Acts, and many of these open fields and common lands were enclosed to make small farms. So if we go back to that map from 1720, at Crawley Mill Farm, this is the map in 1820. All those fields have been amalgamated into small farms. Here we have the fields, in fact, they've got the names that we actually have today, but Furlong, but Close. Those of you who are interested in soil physics, that was where Penman did all his work on evapotranspiration of crops in the field on the Woburn Farm. But besides this enclosure of the land, there was also quite clearly a series of agricultural improvements going on. And two of them, I think, are very important. By this period of the early 17th century, clearly cereals and grain legumes were very well established. And that's why we had, in those early rotations, a cereal followed by a fallow, or a fallow followed by a cereal. And then we went to fallow legume cereal. But by the mid-17th century, turnips as a fodder crop for animals had been introduced into Britain, together with potatoes and red clover. So we now had more crops that we could grow. And based on this, it was possible for the landowners to develop what was called the Norfolk four-course rotation, which became the backbone of arable agriculture both in England and in most of Europe. And it consisted of growing, first of all, turnips, which were fed to cattle, which you then could keep during the winter, spring barley, a grain legume or clover, and winter wheat. So we were actually only growing once in 4 years the staple food of the people. Once in 4 years was our winter wheat crop. And at the same time, Jethro Tull invented the first very modern horse-drawn seed drill. And that enabled, of course, the fact that these small-seeded crops like turnips and barley and clovers could in fact be drilled in rows at a constant depth so that it germinated more uniformly. The days of the traditional biblical, the sower went forth to sow and some of the seed was cast on stony ground, was going, and going very quickly. And he also designed an improved horse-drawn hoe so that you could in fact keep the intero spaces free of weeds. So we had the opportunity to remove weed competition. Now the trouble with all these rotations, of course, was that they were all limited by lack of nutrients. Production was limited by lack of nutrients. We had to have a fallow. During that fallow year, there was weathering of clay minerals and soil particles. There was the mineralization of soil organic matter that had built up to provide nitrogen. And the Norfolk four-course rotation went some way better than that, in that because we were now able to provide winter feed for animals through the turnips and the barley straw, then while the animals were feeding in housing, we were bedded on wheat straw, so we were making farmyard manure. So farmyard manure was a form of recycling the nutrients into these very early systems. The legume, of course, fixed some nitrogen that benefited the growth of the winter wheat as well. And as only barley and wheat grain were sold off the farm, together with some milk and meat products, a lot of the nutrients were being constantly recycled. So this is where we're coming to from in our history. But then, of course, being Britain, perhaps, being European, perhaps, we managed to start raping North America of all its nutrients because we started to import vast quantities of food from North America in particular, and from Africa as well, to feed our animals. And in 1936, Crowther, who was at the time in the chemistry department at Rothamsted, maintained that Britain was importing in animal feed three times as much nitrogen, about the same amount of potassium, and about two-thirds the amount of phosphorus that we were using in fertilizers. We were on a period of intercontinental transfer of nutrients. One of the main issues today, I believe, for sustainability of the world population. This is something we have got to get over. We've got to stop it. We've got to make sure we're doing our best to stop it. So the benefits of the Norfolk four-course rotation then was that the land was cropped every year. Clearly a financial benefit. You didn't have a fallow year when you were growing nothing. In winter, there was feed for the livestock to produce meat and milk. Weed control was facilitated by hoeing, especially of turnips and the grain legumes. There was some nitrogen input from the legumes, and the build-up and spread of plant diseases was limited because you were growing crops in rotation. And as I've already said, plant nutrients were imported in animal feeds and with this intercontinental transfer. And these benefits were so strongly appreciated at a time when nearly all the land in England was farmed by tenant farmers and was owned by a few major landlords, that the major landlords insist that their tenant farmers followed the practice of the locality, which was essentially a four-course rotation. And it was into that background of agricultural productivity that Laws and Gilbert started their experiments. But nearly all of their experiments were in monoculture, and we have to ask why. Laws went as an undergraduate to Oxford University in 1833, and at that time there was a professor at Daubeny there who held three chairs, chemistry, botany, and rural economy. I often point out it just shows how well those traditional universities were interested in science in the 1800s. Now, of course, you'd be lucky to have two or three chairs perhaps in each of those subjects. But Daubeny was an extremely brilliant man in my view. He was the first to distinguish back in the 1830s between active and dormant fractions of soil nutrients. He was working on allelopathy in the botanic gardens there at Oxford University. And he was campaigning vigorously for experiments in agriculture. And it was perhaps these latter two that persuaded Laws to make experiments on crop nutrition and to grow the crops in monoculture, believing that this would be the best way to understand the individual nutrient requirements of those crops. So between 1843 and 1856, Laws and Gilbert started major field experiments on each of the field principal crops grown in the rotation: turnips, winter wheat, field beans, clover, spring barley, and oats. There was only one experiment started in 1848 which grew crops in rotation, and that was on Agdal. But again, it was one crop one year. It didn't have the benefit of our current knowledge and trying to get all phases of all crops every year. And the nutrients, of course, were tested in these either as farmyard manure or as fertilizers. And then just to pick out a few results from those very early years for winter wheat on broadboard, you can see he was getting the same yield with farmyard manure as he was with fertilisers. With spring barley also, with mangels, turnips grown as a root crop, also the same. Now, picking up something that Norman Borlaug said the other night, Laws and Gilbert never, ever wrote in everything that they said that fertilisers were better than farmyard manure. But what Laws and Gilbert realised was that there was no way in which a farmer could produce 35 tonnes per hectare of farmyard manure and put it on every field every year. Clearly, they were well aware of the writings of Malthus in the 1780s about the population growth outstripping our ability to feed that increasing population in the urban areas. And Laws never said, as I said, that farmyard manure was better. He always appreciated that we were only ever going to be able to increase the expanding population of the world if we use fertilizers, but we had to learn to use them judiciously. So what happened then in the 1950s and 1960s? I suppose I should perhaps admit that I went to Rothamsted in 1953 at a time of somewhat great change in that we were able to increase our staff and we were able to increase our interest. But what was happening on Broadbalk essentially was that as restrictions on growing crops in rotation was declining, farmers clearly sought to simplify their cropping patterns. Nitrogen was becoming much more freely available. We didn't have to devote land to feeding horses to provide our power to grow crops. We were able to turn towards tractors. And the question was being asked as a result, why has winter wheat been grown continuously on Broadbalk with no apparent loss in yield, but I, as a farmer farming out in the countryside, cannot do the same? Well, by that time we had identified take-all, Guenomyces graminis, as a root fungal pathogen, and it was known to seriously decrease the yields of winter wheat in British cropping systems. And it was postulated that perhaps a factor inimical to the development of take-all might be responsible for the fact that we were able to maintain our yields on broadboard. And so in 1968, it was decided to modify the experiments on cereals, on winter wheat on broadboard and barley on Hoosefield, to compare the yields of both grown continuously and in rotation. And the first experiment I did deal with very quickly, the rotation on barn field, was potatoes, field beans and cereal. And there's the average there of 9 years of yields. And you can see that if you apply no nitrogen, then there is a benefit of growing crops in rotation. Clearly it's the nitrogen that's coming from those field bean residues. But if you apply enough nitrogen, you get exactly the same yield in both rotations. And we now know reasonably well that spring barley in British conditions is not affected by take-all. And so that experiment reverted to growing spring barley continuously. But the story was absolutely different on Broadbalk. We started all off with a rotation again, the same as on Hoosefield, potatoes, field beans and winter wheat. And again then in that first period we see this major effect here of increasing the rotational yields because we're getting nitrogen from the field beans. But then we get a big yield increase when we apply nitrogen, quite different to what we've seen with spring barley. And this is the effect now of rotation through all this period from 1970 through to 2006. With changing cultivars, we see this increasing yield with the yield potential of the cultivar increases, but we're also seeing a major benefit from having the crop grown in rotation. We've changed the rotation now because of problems of disease, and we're growing oats, maize, and then three wheats. And as has been mentioned this morning just now about what happens if you get from growing a cereal continuously to growing it in rotation. If you try to go back and decide you're going to go rotation-wise again, and this is exactly the same effect that was just been shown, that when you grow your first wheat in a rotation without any nitrogen, you get a yield which is only slightly larger than when it's grown continuously, but then yields decline very considerably in the second and the third year as a result of the buildup of take-all. If you apply two levels of nitrogen at a middling level, you see essentially a big benefit, as we've said, for the first wheat, but yields in the second wheat and the third wheat go plummeting down because take-all is building up faster than the factor which is responsible for the control of take-all. So here we have some knowledge as to what the benefit of rotation might be, and the same with that higher rate of N. Well, we've got to ask now, why was the Norfolk coarse rotation considered to be sustainable? Why do people think we should go back to growing rotations? Why do they think they're going to be more sustainable than growing crops continuously? And I think this is a serious question we've got to ask. But the Norfolk four-course rotation certainly would never have been sustainable without an input of nutrients. And an input of nutrients which was larger than that in the small amount of farmyard manure that could have been applied within that sort of cropping rotation. It's quite interesting that in 1874, there's a couple called Johnston and Cameron. I know I'm getting on in years, but that's not me. And they published a plant food balance for the 9.5 million hectares of land which was growing arable crops in the United Kingdom as it then was, which included what is now the Republic of Ireland. And they estimated the inputs and offtakes in tonnes. And certainly there was a negative balance for nitrogen and also for potassium, and a very small positive balance for phosphorus. The Norfolk four-course rotation, as it was practiced, was not going to be sustainable. And we've got to look, therefore, at the inputs of nutrients which will make it sustainable. A little bit more evidence for that comes from that experiment on Agdal, which was started in 1848, and where, because Laws and Gilbert were unaware of or did not want to confound nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium, which they might have done if they'd put farmyard manure here, they applied P and K, which was equal to the amount of P and K which went in one dressing of farmyard manure, which was meant to last 4 years. And you can see, I think, that where none was given. Now, here we're back to soils, which would have been at the level of nutrients, particularly available phosphorus, which would have been typical of that period of the middle 1800s. In other words, they were not improved soils. And you can see that on a soil which was very low in available phosphorus, the clover gave a very poor yield. It therefore provided a very small amount of nitrogen, and in fact the amount of nitrogen was not even sufficient to equal the amount of nitrogen which was accumulating under the fallow, because these are the mean yields over a period of 12 rotations. Where we have got the P and K, we get a very much better yield of clover, and therefore we get actually in this instance about the same yield of winter wheat, simply because we are getting nitrogen coming out. And I should say that those yields seem very low, but if you could grow 2.5 tonnes of winter wheat or 2.5 tonnes of spring barley in the 1800s, by Jove, you were in there with the money boy. So these were very good yields that you were going to get. A rather similar experiment at Saxmundham, which was started in 1899, which is now part of Rothamsted. And you see that you can look to this where we have treatments for the four crops grown in the rotation without any nutrient inputs. They're quite small. If you apply farmyard manure just to this mangle crop, you increase the yield of mangles. There's a little bit of carryover of nitrogen into the spring barley. The beans benefit by the extra P and K that's been added. They provide a little bit of extra nitrogen which goes to support the winter wheat yield. But if you then apply not only farmyard manure to mangles, but NMP to the winter wheat, you do get, again, a very considerable increase. And this increase to the winter wheat is going through into the mangles. So we've got to have an understanding that we can't grow crops without putting in nutrients. Crops want nutrients. We want food, crops want nutrients. So it comes back to rotations or monoculture. Is there a conflict between growing crops in rotation and monoculture? And clearly, as we've seen already this morning, there is no one answer that fits all situations. To my mind, the essential need is to improve and maintain soil fertility and develop a management cropping system that in the long term will be sustainable. But we've got to remember that whether we're producing it for crops, for food, for feed, for fibre or for biofuels, it has got to be economically viable and it's got to be environmentally acceptable into with today's people are thinking. And economic viability is something that we sometimes tend to forget. As experimenters, it's so easy to say, I will divorce myself from the consequences of this in terms of, am I producing enough to make that farmer financially viable? And it seems to me that there are four factors that we need to consider if we're going to achieve some of these aims. And that is, and I've tried to use the word in harmony here, but the climate, the soil, the crops, and the management, and I particularly stress the management, have got to be in harmony. And two examples. Here's the broad-bought winter wheat experiment, which is actually the same photograph has been very carefully and very nicely, and I do thank them, used by the ASA on the cover of their 2008 calendar. Thank you for that. There's the Who's Barley experiment behind. You can see they're not small experiments. They were designed at a time when there was no thought of replication. Fisher didn't come to Rothamsted till 1913, and this experiment was started in 1843. So clearly, a single pot experiment, but because we've been able to divide it to test these various things, like testing the rotations, we have, if you like, replication in time, and there is a small amount of replication between some of the treatments. So there's the broad-bought wheat experiment. And what do we see? That those are the yields from 1843 to the current period. Here is the yield without the plot, which is given absolutely no nutrients. It is totally biologically sustainable, but it wouldn't put a penny worth of food into anybody's mouth. Here is the crops now, which have grown continuously. As we have increased our yield potential of our cultivars, they've gone up, and winter wheat and farmyard manure, the yields of winter wheat given by farmyard manure and P&K be given 144 kilograms of N are the same. There's no benefit or extra benefit from having that extra organic matter in that soil. Where we grow the first wheat in rotation, as we've seen in some of the figures so far, where we put FYM plus 96 kilograms of nitrogen, we are getting a slightly better yield than with farmyard, with the best fertilizer applications. And that difference was extremely interesting, and unfortunately in the last period with the new variety Heriwood has disappeared, and we can't explain that. But we were seeing big benefits for a while from extra organic matter in soil. The other experiment comes from the Wobenlea arable experiment on that site, which I showed you those very early maps. This is the Wobenlea arable experiment here. Here we do have every phase present every year. Here we do have some replication because, of course, this experiment, which was started in 1937, benefited from that increasing knowledge of how do we conduct an experiment. And the Wobenlea arable was started in 1937. It compares growing grass leys for 3 years and then followed by two test crops of arable crops, or it follows growing arable crops for the whole five-year sequence. And as has already been mentioned this morning, but this took us much longer, it took us nearly 40 years to learn how to run that experiment. And it wasn't because of lack of trying, and it wasn't because of lack of we thought we knew where we were. We had a problem, first of all, with not supplying enough potassium, so we've had to learn to apply nutrients to meet the needs of the crops. In other words, we have to maintain soil fertility, i.e. pH, available P&K and magnesium at the appropriate level. And we've also had to learn to overcome the problems of pests and diseases. And the worst of those on that light sandy loam soil was nematodes. Nematodes went for everything. They went for the cereals, they went for the sugar beet, they went for the lucerne, either stem nematodes or root nematodes. So there is this major interaction with disease, and is the benefit of rotation the fact that we do not get a build-up of pest or disease that we cannot, in fact, control chemically? Because we can't control take-all chemically. So on broad, what we have to grow rotation to get the best yield to minimize the take-all effect. And towards the increase, at the end of this 40 years, we've got very small increases in organic matter from the lays compared to the all-arable rotations. I'll show you the figures for cereals in a minute. They might have been more beneficial to potatoes. And of course, what you find in that situation, these are the results from 1938 through to the current period. there's the soil which has had no all arable cropping, and you can see that the organic matter is slowly declining. But on the other hand, on that particular soil, provided you get enough nitrogen, give enough nitrogen, and you've controlled all your pests and diseases, you get exactly the same yield as you do where we have been growing a grass layer with nitrogen for 3 years, followed by the winter wheat. But then there, of course, rightly, you get a higher yield with a smaller input of nitrogen than you do on the all arable rotation. If you grow a grass clover lay, then of course you get an even better yield, and you want actually less nitrogen to achieve that optimum yield. So there are these interactions with nitrogen. So how then do we assess and maintain the sustainability of a farming system? Clearly it depends on soil fertility, and which is a complex of interactions between the biological, chemical and physical properties of soil. It's probably unusual for a single factor to cause a farming system to collapse. It could be biological or chemical or physical or any combination. And these changes very often are going to be very slow and therefore difficult to identify. And as far as I know, really, there is no way, simple way, in which to characterize soil fertility in the round. We can characterize individual aspects, but I don't know of any index system that will say 10 for this soil, minus 5 for that. It's the growing plant which responds to all three properties and tells us whether the soil conditions are such that it can achieve its yield potential. So whether a cropping is in a monoculture or in a rotation, it seems to me to be immaterial, provided that the crops do achieve that yield potential, that soil fertility is maintained, that the farming system is financially viable and socially acceptable, and that it is environmentally benign. And I'm sure you would agree with me, many of you, that to assess these three criteria needs long-term experiments, but I'm not so stupid as to suggest we all go out and start them, because funding them these days is getting ever more difficult, as we find at Rothamsted, and as I'm sure those of you who are responsible for field experiments find everywhere else. Thank you.
That was on the Agdal experiment. Yes, go on. Yep.
How important is that aspect? Because we continue to have discussions about, if we talk about fertility and sustainability, this the fill versus the removal paradigm.
We've done a lot of work, and there's a number of papers published where we have tried to come in many of our experiments. We've now got a lot of experimental evidence to show that we can define a critical level for soil phosphorus measured as Olsen phosphorus in our soils. And that level generally across the UK would be said to be 25 milligrams per kilogram. But again, it will come down if you've got a very nice soil which is easy to cultivate, where roots proliferate very easily. That difference between 17 and 6 was interesting too, because where we'd been growing clover, where they'd been growing clover, it was lower than where they had had the fallow simply because of the offtake. And I think that is another crucial aspect. We've got to balance inputs with against offtakes when we have got to the critical value. And you can, on some soils, we know that we can build it up reasonably quickly. On other soils, we know that we can't. But I've got a lot of evidence now that we will define critical values.
Short question, someone might have. 30 seconds, yes.
Do you have the information on nitrogen losses through denitrification?
There is, yes, colleagues have been making measurements on both leaching losses to the drains and on denitrification losses to the atmosphere. It depends on how you want to determine the efficiency of use. If you do it by the difference method, the efficiency of use is somewhere about 50%, 50-60%, because the amount of nitrogen which is in the no-N plot is now very small. And this is one of the curses of using the difference method. The difference method invariably depends upon how much nitrogen you're getting to get out of your no-N treatment. But the N15, on Broadbrook, oddly enough, the N15 experiments, which were done way back in the early 1970s, also give an efficiency of about 50%. But we have to be fair and say that on the high N plots, we still get a loss of nitrogen from the plot which gets no nitrogen, that we get about the same amount from the plot which gets the lowest amount of nitrogen input, which is essentially 50 kilograms per hectare, and the losses are moving a little bit towards the concentrations which we would think were on about the world health limit for nitrogen in drinking water, with 192 kilograms of impact.